Much has been written recently about the beat writers like Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, William Burroughs, and in the story of this now famous circle of men, women were frequently the friends or lovers, minor characters. My guest is Joyce Johnson, whose new memoir about the 1950s is called Minor Characters. She tells about leaving her controlled and ordered Jewish middle-class family life in uptown Manhattan to go downtown to Greenwich Village, where she became a part of a bohemian crowd. Then in 1957, she met Jack Kerouac, and they were lovers for 2 years. Kerouac lived with her during his intervals in Manhattan between trips to Tangier, San Francisco, Mexico, and Florida. Joyce Johnson's new book, Minor Characters, is published by Houghton Mifflin. She is an executive editor at the Dial Press. She's written 2 novels, Come and Join the Dance and Bad Connections. Joyce Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Before we talk, I'd like to ask you to read the opening passage from your book.
Sure. The snapshot is in a book now, 4 young men on the Columbia campus on a day in 1945. Early spring, maybe, because the coats of 3 of them are open at the collar, and the tree in the background is bare. They're boys, really. As I've grown older, the figures in the photo have grown younger. They're dressed with that startling formality of the period that seems peculiarly innocent now. Short hair, long overcoats. Burroughs is even wearing a black bowler, a sort of British banker effect, a deliberate costume. He's absenting himself in his disguise. Hal Chase, whom I never met, the one who introduced them all to Neil Cassidy, looks like the sharp kid about to save the situation with a joke. Allen Ginsberg is all adolescent gawkiness and misery. He shut his eyes as if the taking of the picture is an intolerable intrusion. And there's Jack Kerouac in the center. No overcoat, just a cheap baggy suit, in which his football hero's shoulders look enormous, loud tie pulled askew. He stretched his arms over Chase and Allen so that his fingertips reach Burroughs' shoulder. A cigarette dangles from his mouth in the romantic style of jazz piano players or hard-boiled all-night journalists in movies. He's grinning directly warmly at the photographer as the shutter clicks, the only one of them totally connected to the moment. I look in the index of the book with a snapshot of Jack and Allen and the others, and there I find Joyce Glassman and 6 page references having to do with approximately 1/20th of my life, 1957 to 59, when I used to have that name.
That's Joyce Johnson reading from the opening of her new book, Minor Characters, her memoir of the 1950s. And Joyce Johnson was then Joyce Glassman. Well, I'm sure if what you do when you find a new book on that period or on Kerouac is look at the index and see if
I always look at the index.
How do you feel about the way you've been described in those books?
Well, you know, anyone who's written about by anyone always has a very odd feeling finding what's written about them on the pages of a book. It always seems slightly distorted or askew, or the wrong things have been emphasized. It's like listening to your own voice on tape. You can't quite recognize it. But actually, I have felt that, you know, many of the things that have been written about Jack have not really bothered very much to go into the various women that Jack knew, I myself among them. There hasn't been much interest in those women, and the focus really has been on Jack and the Beats. In certain of these books, there's also been a kind of lack of affect about the whole way the story of Jack is told. There's been an enormous amount of research, but you get sort of a laundry list of he went here, he went there, he went to Mexico, he got drunk, he took up with this one, he saw that one, and it doesn't give me any sense of the person that I knew, even though I admire the enormous research efforts.
What did you decide to write your book at this time?
Well, I think I've wanted to write this book for around 25 years, ever since I went through those times in the late 50s. I wanted to be a writer even back then, and it was obvious to me that even then that this was probably wonderful material. I didn't write a book at the time because I think I felt I really didn't have any perspective on it, and also because I really didn't want to go through the rest of my life labeled as the girl who knew Jack Kerouac. I wanted to be my own person. So I wrote other things, and it's always mysterious the way you get the idea for a book. I mean, if you sit down and try to figure out what book you're going to write, you're usually nothing comes very often. As it happens, I was actually writing another book, a novel, which I haven't completed and probably never will. And I was, in 1979, I was away on a business trip. I was in London, and I got off the plane. I was very jet-lagged. It was the first night I was there. And some friends took me out to hear jazz in a little London club, kind of an underground, dark place. And there were some old Kansas City jazz musicians there, men in their 70s. And I marveled at them. They were terrific. They were still playing beautiful music. They were enjoying themselves. They had diamond rings on their fingers. And I thought, how amazing that people, you know, of this age are still on the road, still practicing their art. And then I thought of a younger generation of jazz musicians, the Charlie Parkers, the Coltranes, people like that, who are no longer around, who died prematurely. And these are the people I associate with some of the people I knew, writers and artists back in the 1950s. And I suddenly got a sense that the time had come when I was ready to write this book, and that's what I should be doing.
How did you meet Kerouac?
I met Kerouac in a very amusing manner. It was a blind date arranged by Allen Ginsberg, of all people. Allen Ginsberg was involved with a very, very close friend of mine, whom I write about in Minor Characters, a woman named Elise Cowan. Elise and I had been in college together at Barnard. And Elise had been seeing Allen on and off for a couple of years whenever he was around New York. He came to New York with Jack in the fall of 1956. This was right at the time that people became aware that interesting things were happening in San Francisco. There'd been the famous reading of Howl and a lot of press about it. They were on their way to Tangier, where they planned to visit William Burroughs. And Jack was sort of broke and lonely, and Allen decided that he should fix Jack up with a girl. And so one day I was over at Elise's apartment where Allen was staying, and the phone rang, and it was for me, and it was Jack, and he said, "Hi, I'm Jack. I hear you're very nice. Why don't you come and meet me? I will be at Howard Johnson's on 6th Avenue and 8th Street, and then I'll be wearing a red and black check shirt, and I have black hair." So I said, "Sure." So I went down and met him, and that was how it all began.
He didn't have enough money to pay.
He didn't have
for
enough.
What he ordered.
No.
Did you feel used by that? Since?
No, I didn't. He had an unfortunate experience. I think he was down to his last $10 or $20, and he'd gone to a grocery store that day, and he'd been shortchanged, so he was really penniless. And so I bought him dinner. I'd never bought anyone dinner before. It was something very vulnerable about Jack. I was 21 years old, but I sort of felt I wanted to take care of him.
You write in your book, he could somehow cancel you out and make you feel sad for him at the same time. Would you explain that?
There was a lot of distance in Jack. He was someone who kept trying to see whether he could be absolutely alone. At the time that I met him, he had very recently had the whole experience of being on a mountain in the state of Washington called Desolation Peak. He'd been there alone in a fire lookout's cabin for 63 days, confronting the void. And it had been a very important experience, also a rather frightening experience for him. But that was always his ideal, though, that he could go off and be alone like that. And he never was able to do that very successfully.
When you became lovers, what role did he want you to play in his life, and what role did you want him to play in yours?
Well, he was very much a friend to me. He had done all these wonderful things which I loved hearing about. He was very interested in my writing. He was quite a lot older than I was. He was 13 years older. He wasn't looking for a steady woman in his life. His life was constantly punctuated by departures for various places. And there was one female presence in his life that was all important, that left very little room for other people, and that of course was his mother. As for me, I was crazy about him. It was very, very exciting knowing him. I had, as I said, this sort of instinct that I sort of had to, in some way, take care of him. I think I felt that I was 21 years old, and this was somehow a very important and unique experience, and that even if it didn't work out into anything permanent, which I realistically didn't think it would, that it was an experience worth having and one I wouldn't regret.
Do you think there was like a typical job description for the girlfriend of the beat writer of the time, the role you're supposed to play?
I don't know about that. You know, a lot of people did get married. There were some long-lasting relationships. Jack had problems with, you know, maintaining relationships with a single woman over a long period of time. Not everybody was that way at all. There were a lot of sort of fairly domestic scenes around the whole crowd and in the East Village. But that was sort of Jack's style. A lot of the women down there were young women like me who had sort of broken away from home, were trying to have some kind of free and independent life, were attracted to bohemianism, and were attracted to men who sort of exemplified that freedom. What I think none of us understood was that these men who exemplified freedom to us would also put us into rather traditional roles, and that we would not be their comrades. It would not be the sort of true equality that we all hoped for.
Did you think of it in those terms at the time?
I think that's what my ideal was at that time. That's still my ideal, and that's a very, very hard, rare thing to find, even now, even though we've come such a long way in consciousness.
But, I mean, did you think at the time, in terms of the people who were free in their own lives, having the women in their lives consigned to very specific secondary kinds of roles?
It was much easier to accept then, because things were very, very different at that time. And I think it's really hard for, say, people in their 20s to understand how very, very different things were 25 years ago, which is not that far away from us in time. It was before the 60s, before women's liberation, before the pill, before legalized abortion. It was rather an extraordinary thing at that time for a young woman from a middle-class family to leave home and get her own apartment if she wasn't going to be married. This was, you know, really frowned upon. It was assumed that she was going to be loose and promiscuous and probably get into trouble. And so just breaking away from home was an enormous struggle for a young woman.
You say that you felt you didn't fit Kerouac's ideal of his romantic model, that you weren't dark and you weren't the kind of earthy.
He had this
figure.
Ideal of what he called the fellaheen woman. Because in a way Jack was also innately conservative. He always had this conservative streak that was at war with his whole sort of free nature. He had two things going on in him at the same time. He's a very ambivalent character. I think, you know, he probably felt some kind of sexual freedom with black women or Mexican women, or thought he might feel some sexual freedom that he didn't feel with you know, middle-class white women.
I think a lot of women have felt that about certain lovers, that somehow they were together at the time, but they weren't really the ideal. They weren't the model being searched for. How did you handle that?
It was painful to me, and it made me feel insecure. One of the first things, when that first night that I met Jack, one of the things he said to me was, "The trouble is, I don't like blondes." And I laughed and said, "Well, in that case, maybe I'll just dye my hair." But it was still a painful thing.
Did you ever resent that?
Sure.
You've read all of his books in which his characters are based on people that he knew and based on ideals. Were there characters in his book that you felt were based on you in some way?
Yeah, I appear in one of his books, In Desolation Angels, under the name of Alice Newman.
And what do you think of the way he wrote about that character, and what was it like for you the first time you read the book?
Oh, I didn't feel he did me justice. But as I said, there's always this distortion reading what other people write about you. And Jack, in many of his books, was not a writer who lingered over the nuances of relationships. He did have one exception to this, of course, was the book The Subterraneans, which was, you know, where he wrote about his relationship with a young black woman named Mardu Fox. And it was a very honest book because he really got into the whole question of the way his feelings about his mother stood between his ability to love another woman.
Did you ever talk about the characters in his books as they compare to real life, or as you compare it to the character based on you?
Well, once he took me to meet the woman that he had based The Subterraneans on. And it was a funny experience because I had been very, very moved by The Subterraneans. And, you know, I'd been so involved in the book. I felt sad that the love affair in the book had been so doomed, that these two people had not gotten together. I was sort of under the spell of the book. And then I met this this young woman who was, you know, kind of angry at Jack, very tired, had a lot of sort of personal problems, had a kind of ironic attitude about, well, you've really exploited the scene and, you know, that kind of an attitude.
Must have been an odd scene when you met them.
It was an odd scene.
After all, she was in a way your rival, I guess, for his love attentions. Mm.
At the same time, I had this sort of hangover of empathy from the book, so it was a strange evening.
You quote a passage in here from Desolation Angels, and maybe you can read this for us. And if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Joyce Johnson, and just going to read a passage from her new book, Minor Characters, in which she quotes part of Kerouac's writing.
I'm a regular fool in pale houses, enslaved to lust for women who hate me. They lay their bartering flesh all over the divans. It's one flesh pot, insanity, all of it. I should forswear and chew him all out and go hit the clean rail. I wake up glad to find myself saved in the wilderness mountains. For that lumpy roll flesh with a juicy hole, I'd sit through eternities of horror in gray rooms, illuminated by a gray sun, with cops and alimoners at the door and the jail beyond. It's a bleeding comedy. The great wise stages of pathetic understanding elude me when it comes to harems. Harem scarem, it's all in heaven now. Bless all their bleating hearts. Some lambs are female. Some angels have woman wings. It's all mothers in the end, and forgive me for my sardony. Excuse me for my rut.
What do you think of that passage?
That's a very misogynist, painful passage. I mean, he did, you know, he did have those feelings of hatred, some hatred for women, for the sexual power they had over him, for his own capacity, his own weakness in getting involved with them, some guilt that he had for being sexually involved with women when he thought of his mother, who he really idolized. There's a reference in there to cops and alimoners at the door in the jail beyond. That was because he was actually being pursued by his second wife, by whom he had had a child, who was, you know, trying to get child support money from him and so on. He also had a real horror of being tied down to a woman in a matrimonial way and then to have the burden of supporting her, which he felt would enslave him and make it impossible for him to write. It would come between him and his work.
The impression I get from that passage is of woman as a bad habit, one that you'd be better off breaking.
At the same time, he actually liked women, loved women. You know, people carry a lot of contradictions inside them. It was interesting, and Jack especially. I was at Boulder last summer. There was a festival celebrating the 25th anniversary of On the Road, and people were constantly, all kinds of people were trying to reconcile the various contradictions in Kerouac's character. You know, he was radical, but he was conservative. He was heterosexual, but he was homosexual. He drank a lot, but how did he remember everything? You know, conversations sort of went back and forth in that manner.
Studying Kerouac has almost become a cottage industry now.
Has.
What do you think of that?
Well, Kerouac has really spawned a great many books. There's even a sort of a small magazine called the Moody Street Irregulars that goes out to fans and presents a lot of latest stuff about Kerouac and odd bits of information. Unlike, I guess, a lot of writers who came after the Beats have left an enormous trail of documents behind them. They were great letter writers. Jack hated to use the phone, and you know, he would rattle off all kinds of letters to friends. There were journals. The same is true of Allen Ginsberg, who there's a whole collection in Columbia University that was donated by Allen of all kinds of letters and journals and notebooks. And even he's forgotten what's in there. People are, you know, someone will come upon a notebook he wrote in 1956 that contains some very interesting things, and he's very amazed. He'd totally forgotten that it existed. So this has made it easy in a way for someone who wants to write a book about the Beats to assemble it from all these documentary materials. The real problem comes in making sense of all this. I mean, you can put all this stuff down and rattle off all this information, and you can end up with a laundry list.
But I have a feeling what you're writing about isn't things that are included in those documents and in the letters and in the journals.
Right, right.
Because you're observing it as a woman, and I think that that perspective was really different.
Yeah, it was a different perspective. One of the best biographies about Jack was written by a woman. That's the first one, the Anne Charters. And Anne had a real feeling for Jack and for the Beats and had been around San Francisco in the old days. Some of the younger people who followed and who have basically done all this in libraries have not done very successful books, to my way of thinking.
Joyce Johnson is my guest if you're just joining us, and we're discussing her memoir called Minor Characters, and it's about her life in the 1950s, 2 years of which she was lovers with Jack Kerouac. Your friend Elise Cowan, who you mentioned before, was during one of Allen Ginsberg's heterosexual periods lovers with him. And
that's right.
She was really pretty obsessed with him, I guess, even when he
she was
clearly gay.
Yeah.
So Ginsberg was and is homosexual, which means that the whole role of the woman as your lover and helpmate didn't really apply to him. Do you think that his sense of women or sexual politics was in any way different from the heterosexual writer friends of his?
Well, I think women occupied a much less important place in Allen's life than they did in many of the other, heterosexual writers around him. He's always had women friends and been involved fleetingly anyway with various women. His relationship with my friend Elise persisted in various forms for about 10 years. It sort of went on, and he had a sort of rare understanding in a way. There's a very little poignant notation in one of Allen's journals. It was Elise who typed the manuscript of Kaddish, which was the poem about his mother, Naomi, who I think Elise reminded him of a bit. And she finished typing the poem, and she said to him, "You're not done with her yet." And Allen noted this down in his journal. I think because he felt that she was right.
Mm-hmm. Kerouac did a lot of traveling. You never traveled with him. What were the reasons for that?
Well, I always wanted more than anything to go on the road with Jack. I was always it's rather amusing. Now, he had been in Tangier and he was expecting to stay there a long time, but he didn't like it very much, as it turned out. Came back to the States much earlier than he expected. Passed through New York, and he was planning to go out to California and to make his permanent home in San Francisco. And we agreed that I would come out there. I had really never been out of New York in my life. I was very young. I had a wonderful salary in those days of about $50 a week. So I didn't have great financial resources on which to go traveling. I sold my first novel that summer, though, and got $500 for it. And it seemed that then I could really pick up stakes and go out and be with Jack. But then Jack got fed up with San Francisco and wrote me a letter that the vibrations were bad, the cops were all over watching everybody because of the obscenity trial of Howell, and that he was pulling up stakes and going to Mexico City, and he thought that would be the place that we should be together. So I sort of regrouped and said, fine, I'll meet you in Mexico City. But then Mexico City didn't work out for him either. There was sort of an earthquake there, and he got very depressed there and ill. So he left Mexico City after about a week and stopped off at his mother's house in Florida, and then ended up in New York in time for the publication of On the Road. He hadn't planned to be in New York when On the Road was published. The original plan was that he and I would be in Mexico together. And then he said, well, maybe Viking might like to have me around when On the Road comes out. And he had absolutely no idea that he was going to be hit by that whole incredible wave of publicity and that he would become a kind of culture hero and leader of a movement. And he hadn't planned any of that at all.
You said the only woman who he ever really traveled with was his mother. Do you think that he intentionally excluded women from those travels?
Well, I think when he traveled with his mother, he was always sort of picking her up and moving her on to yet another place. He was always sort of looking for a home. And I think, in a way, Jack was always looking for a place where he could be. Maybe he would feel good in Europe. Maybe he would feel good in Tangier. Maybe it would be Mexico City that would be right. And he would always imagine these places and paint a whole wonderful picture of them for himself. And then when he'd get there, reality would be too much for him. It wouldn't match the picture he'd painted. and he'd have his own unhappiness and pain to contend with, and so the place would be no good, and he'd have to move on and try another place. So that was the pattern. And he would take his mother with him to various places, whether they would set up stakes. He had a big thing about always wanting to buy a house for his mother. He had promised his father that he would buy his mother a house someday, and this was a promise he was able to fulfill after the success of On the Road.
You visited them in houses that they shared.
I visited them only in one house, the one in Northport, Long Island.
And he always said that in his house with his mother that a woman couldn't sleep over because it wouldn't be right.
Right, because unmarried people couldn't sleep under the same roof with his mother.
Did it ever seem really absurd to you that this person who had become a cultural hero to his generation and who had written all these stories about lovers in his own house couldn't have a lover?
Oh, it seemed absolutely crazy to me. But, you know, that was something, it was just a quirk of Jack's. It was infuriating and it was crazy. But that was the way he was.
Did it seem crazy to him?
I think he might have admitted that it seemed crazy to him too, but it was a very, very deep thing.
Was it out of respect to his mother or out of fear? Sometimes people don't do that out of fear.
Out of respect, he didn't want to upset her. She was also, you know, pretty hostile to most of the, any young woman that he would bring home with him. I understand I met Edie Kerouac, who was Jack's first wife, last summer. And Edie said she had gotten together with Jack when she was 19 years old and he was about 20. And that at that time, the mother had been very friendly to her. And so evidently the mother sort of changed her attitude sort of over the years.
You were living together at the time On the Road was published, and it got a fabulous review as soon as it came out, and then lots of writers and interviewers came to interview him. What did you think of the whole Beat Generation press that got started after the publication of that book?
Well, a lot of Jack did receive an overwhelming amount of attention, not all of it friendly by any means. There was a lot of hostility toward him that was expressed in newspapers, and even in the way he was interviewed on a television talk show. And he was really one of the first authors to be on the talk show. The talk show as an institution had only been around for a couple of months at the time that On the Road was published. So a lot of these encounters with the press and the media were very, very painful and difficult occasions, and more he would have to drink a lot in order to get himself to meet an interviewer. And he would be sort of out of control, and he would be embarrassed by what happened, so it got to be more and more difficult for him to do. And he would always think, well, maybe he should simply refuse to do all that stuff, and then he would not be able to refuse. And he just got more and more tired.
How were you treated by the press?
They weren't very interested in me, which was fine. I didn't really want publicity.
What role did you try to play then? Did you set up interviews or?
No, I didn't. Jack's publicity was very much handled by his publisher, by Viking Press, and a very nice lady who was the publicity director, who was absolutely stunned by the kind of attention Jack was getting. She had never expected anything like it. She had never seen anything like it. And she was a little distressed by it, too, as though she had created a Frankenstein.
You said that he came back from traveling and found that so many people in America were imitating him through the books, and he didn't like what he saw. What were some of those things that he saw that disturbed him so much?
I think he felt that his way of living, the kind of freedom that he had, his kind of style, was something that was sort of very hard won, you know, and it had come out of sort of deep need and deep feeling, and that being beat became available as a style to lots of people who could not sort of go through the various stages to get there. You could decide you were going to be a beatnik, and you could go and buy a black turtleneck sweater, you know, and act in a certain way and use a certain vocabulary, and everybody would think you were a beatnik. And that was very boring, and it kind of took the whole meaning of it away.
During that period, was it, were you supposed to be the exemplary beatnik? Since you were known in some circles as his lover, were you supposed to exemplify anything? Did you have to change your behavior in any way or look the part in any way?
No, I didn't feel I had to exemplify anything. I found it very arduous being Jack Kerouac's girlfriend, because it seemed to me rather terrifying. We would go places. It seemed to me that people were almost wanted to devour him. I remember having a nightmare one night about going with Jack to a lecture or a reading and people tearing him apart limb from limb before my eyes. And that was a feeling I had about people. I found it terribly, terribly disturbing. And I would kind of try to look out for him. And you know, as the evening went on and he drank more and more, things would get more and more difficult and out of control. And I would keep trying to get him home so he could rest and sober up and so on.
Sometimes when you're with someone who's well-known and very, very popular, people will talk to them as if you're truly invisible and
don't exist.
Oh, as
if you don't exist, yeah.
How did
yeah.
you handle situations like that?
Sometimes I would say very insulting things to people. I would throw people out of the house.
Did you consciously decide to be aggressive about that? Because other people might just get very insecure and depressed.
Sometimes I was pretty aggressive about it. I remember going to a party and one woman who'd been flirting outrageously with Jack all evening said to me, "Oh, your boyfriend's a homo, isn't he?"
What'd you say?
So I said, "Yes, I am too." How does that strike you? She backed away.
What do you think the fans expected he was like?
I think the fans expected someone like Neil Cassidy. They got him confused with Neil Cassidy. He was a much more extroverted character. And so they thought he would be like Dean Moriarty in On the Road rather than Sal Paradise, who was very much the writer, the observer, the shy person, watching as all these other people do these extraordinary things. You know, that very, very famous passage in On the Road that's so often quoted about shambling on down the road as all these mad people, sort of hungry for life, do their thing and they go off like firecrackers. And that was very much Jack, the person shambling along, a little bit behind everybody else, watching and looking, listening.
You said it was when you read...
Saying, wow, mm-hmm. look at these people.
You said it was when you read The Subterraneans that you realized the relationship was about to be over. What was it in the book that gave you the realization?
Well, that was The Subterraneans was a very clear statement about Jack's deep, deep hang-ups about women and the role that his mother played in these. And it said to me that not only that he had these hang-ups, but he was also very, very conscious of them and resigned to them and saw them, in a sense, as his tragedy. And it seemed there was no hope.
So you decided that...
It wasn't something that he did unconsciously. He knew it. That's what I felt.
So you decided to just give up on the relationship?
Well, no, that wasn't the end of our relationship at the time, but it was a very sobering thing. I never really realistically thought we would end up married or in any long permanent thing, and this seemed to say it to me more than anything else, although the relationship went on for some time after that.
When the relationship ended, did you go through a phase of reorienting your identity in any way or your image?
No, I didn't really. I was still living downtown. I was very much a part of this whole scene in the East Village. I had made a lot of friends. I continued to sort of live down there and to live that life and that whole very exciting world I had come into, which was very important to me. I had a kind of split existence because I've always had jobs, so I would have my straight job uptown in a publisher's office and come downtown and eat my dinner as fast as I could so I could rush out of the house again and be where all the exciting things were happening.
Was it easier for you to write when you weren't together?
I really wasn't able to write while Jack was around, and it may be that... I've had two marriages, and in neither marriage was I able to write while I was married.
Why do you think?
I don't know. It may be that I need to be alone to write. This is a question I keep asking myself. I don't live entirely alone because I live with my son, but it's very different than living with a husband or a lover.
You read
a certain kind of privacy, I guess, that I require.
You write also about Hetty Cohn Jones, who was married to Leroy Jones, now Amiri Baraka,
yeah,
for a while. She was white, and he later was pretty bitter about that marriage.
He felt under a lot of pressure by the politics of that time, which were pushing him to taking a black separatist position. So right after the assassination of Malcolm X, actually, he decided to leave her and to move to Harlem into, you know, a black community, not to have any more white friends. And he renounced a lot of, not only Hetty, but a lot of friends that he was very close to.
Are you still friends with her?
I'm still, yes. Hetty is one of my very close friends.
Do you talk much about those times?
We do. We do. And we really see a great deal through the prism of those times.
How do you think that affects your perspective? I mean, how does that make you see differently than other people?
I think probably it does. I think it was, you know, one of the important formative experiences of my life. I came out of it with certain real ideals that may or may not have been realized. I still feel that it should be possible for men and women to have a relationship that's sort of based on true comradeship, so that I think men and women should be able to go on the road together, for example, and to be able to communicate with each other about their work, and have some, that the woman's work should be respected as much as the man's. I have never been very much neither on acquiring lots of expensive possessions. I've never been too interested in status. I miss that community of artists and writers that I knew back then. It dissipated, and I've never found anything since to equal it.
When you were a teenager and living with your parents in a middle-class Jewish home and uptown in Manhattan, you so much wanted to leave that and become a part of the circle of artists and writers in the village. At what point did you feel like you had done it, that you had really become that person who you wanted to be, and that those ties to the middle class controlled experience had been broken?
I think it was around the time that I met Jack, and that I moved down to the East Village and became part of this sort of circle of people. My life had taken on a very, very definite shape that was very different from the one my parents had known. And, you know, there was a price to be paid, but it was where I wanted to be.
Can you read us another selection from your book?
Sure. Actually, this is one of my favorite passages in the book. This is a part of a chapter where I'm 13 years old. It's 1949. And I describe my first trip down to the village from the Upper West Side. I've heard about the village from older girls in my high school. I was very interested in folk music at the time, and they told me that there were folk singers in Washington Square every Sunday. So I went down with a girlfriend of mine to investigate, and then that was the beginning of it all for me, my whole involvement with the village. I kept going back. I got home that first Sunday just in time for dinner. What did I tell my parents that night? Maria and I spent the afternoon doing homework. We went to the movies. Did my mind race guiltily through the current attractions, picking the one we saw? I knew the truth would be fatal. We took the Fifth Avenue bus to Washington Square. We talked to strange men. We went with them to the Art Center, which was not a center of all the arts, as I'd first thought, but a luncheonette on 8th Street, a classic greasy spoon that would be rechristened the Griddle less misleadingly 2 years later. There we had coffee, which I was not allowed to drink at home. It seemed as wicked to drink coffee as to drink a martini. I had to put 6 sugars in mine to get it down. The men talked to Maria, really, rather than to me. Mostly they talked to each other about versions of folk songs that they wrote down in little notebooks. And someone called Pete Seeger, and there was a joke ending with the punchline, "What's the party line on that?" which made them all laugh. The blonde girl necked with her boyfriend. She kicked off her shoes under the table. The man in the wheelchair was a doomed millionaire who lived on Park Avenue. He was a hemophiliac, which I had never heard of. Maria whispered to me it meant that if he got even a tiny scratch, he'd bleed to death. He was bloated and greenish pale, with brown circles under his eyes, and quite irritable, which seemed understandable under the circumstances. He collected guitars, banjos, hundreds of folk and blues records. People, too, these people, for whom we heard he gave parties uptown, astonishing the snooty doormen with his guests. Would Maria and I ever go to any of these parties? What all this seemed to promise was something I'd never tasted in my life as a child, something I told myself was real life. This was not the life my parents lived, but one that was dramatic, unpredictable, possibly dangerous, therefore real, infinitely more worth having. In trying to trace the derivations of this notion of experience, I come into blind alleys. It was simply there all of a sudden, full-fledged, like a fever I'd come down with. The air carries ideas like germs, infecting some, not others. Real life was not to be found in the streets around my house, or anywhere on the Upper West Side, for that matter, or in my school of girls grubbing joylessly for marks, hysterical about geometry exams and Latin homework, flirting ridiculously with a 70-year-old elevator operator, the only male visible on the premises. Real life was sexual, or rather, it often seemed to take the form of sex. This was the area of ultimate adventure, where you would dare or not dare. It was much less a question of desire. Sex was like a forbidden castle whose name could not even be spoken around the house, so feared was its power. Only with the utmost vigilance could you avoid being sucked into its magnetic field. The alternative was to break into the castle and take its power for yourself.
That's a great passage. It's Joyce Johnson reading a selection from her new book, Minor Characters. Well, you say in your book that during that period for you that all the sexual experimentation in your crowd was really serious. I mean, it was taken really seriously, and it seems like there was a lot of anguish surrounding it, too. Why was that?
Well, I just, let me say that for women at the time, and I think this is still true more often than not, whereas men could go on the road and climb mountains and hitchhike on highways and have that kind of very male, macho adventure, like the guy in Blue Highways who got in a car and drove all around America. Women's great adventure usually was sexual. It was getting involved with sort of a challenging man, taking a risk, and that was what the adventure was for women. It was the big difference. It's a big difference in between men's notion of experience and women's notion of it. Whereas for a man, an encounter with a girl as he's hitchhiking is just like a little sort of stop along the way. For a woman, that encounter might be the high point, the most important part of another whole adventure.
I should think it was a much more difficult time to have sexual relations and not get pregnant than it is now, because there was less options available.
It was a very, very difficult time. A lot of things that really people take for granted now that have, you know, profoundly changed mores just didn't exist then. It was very, very hard to get birth control devices. If you wanted to get a diaphragm, if you went to the Margaret Sanger Clinic, you would have to lie, actually, to get one. You'd have to get a wedding ring from the 5- and 10-cent store and say you were married and give your husband's name and all of that, which prevented a lot of people from going to get those devices. This was before the pill. Abortion was illegal and extremely dangerous. If you need an abortion, you might not even be able to find an abortionist very, very easily. And some women paid terribly for having some degree of sexual experience. And in a sense, you really took your life in your hands.
Was it a macho thing then for a man to say, "Don't worry about it. I can handle it. I won't get you pregnant."
And then get you pregnant.
Yeah.
It was, unfortunately.
You were pregnant and got an abortion.
Yeah.
Would you tell us what that abortion was like? It sounded like it was a really horrible experience.
It was. I didn't have any names of any doctors who did this. I had to ask all around. And finally, I heard about one doctor out in Brooklyn. You could get to him if you went through a kind of middleman, who was a guy who worked in an advertising agency, who seemed to derive some strange pleasure from taking girls out to get abortions. He got real kicks from it, and he would try to date them afterwards. So I contacted him, and he took me out there to this house in Brooklyn. The doctor was this very kind of angry guy who yelled at me and treated me as though I were a bad girl, but actually did the abortion very, very carefully. So I was lucky. I didn't have any bad effects from it medically. He was very careful. He was also scared to death. I had to keep my shoes on all through the operation in case the police came and I had to run for it. My experience was better than a lot of other experiences of people who were very, very ill or died. My friend Elise, who I write about in the book, had gone to San Francisco with no money, became pregnant out there, couldn't afford an illegal abortion, so had to convince authorities in California that she was crazy so she could get a psychiatric abortion. This process took 4 months by the time she had an abortion. It was a hysterotomy and, you know, a profoundly upsetting and dangerous experience.
You probably assumed you might be risking your life to get this abortion.
I did. I didn't. When I went out that morning to go to see this doctor, I wondered whether I would be coming home.
Why did you do it, given the risks?
There just seemed no other way. I was 20 years old. I was making $50 a week. I could hardly take care of myself, much less a child. I was afraid to tell my parents because they would have been it would have been terribly painful for them and upsetting. I felt I had to sort of take care of it and take the consequences, whatever they were.
Were there people who you think would have felt that you deserved to be punished for having sexual
definitely,
relations?
Oh, definitely at that time.
Did you ever have to stop thinking that way yourself, since you were brought up in a family where you didn't have sex until you were married, and certainly in a whole society where just about everybody felt that way? How did you get to not feel that way?
Well, I think people had a lot of conflicts about sex, and even if you were, you know, you decided you wanted to be sexually free in those days, I don't think you felt free inside. I think people did not have a great many good sexual experiences in those days. There was just so much anxiety around the whole act.
Was there a lot of misinformation going around too?
Yeah, there was a lot of misinformation, and there wasn't much thought about the quality of the experience in a way that there, you know, people go into all that now. It was a very, very different time.
Did women who you knew talk about it together?
To a degree, but not as they did later on.
When you were that age, you were already serious about becoming a writer. And when you went to college, you were in writing classes. And one of your writing teachers there told you that, you know, if the people in the class were really serious about being writers, they'd be riding boxcars around
which
the
country. Was absolutely absurd. It was a class of young women, and it was 1953. In other words, forget it, girls. There's no hope. You're girls, you know. And we would write things in the class, and he would return them with comments like, "Oh, all you girls have such dreary little lives." And this was a very important, you know, women's college. But you know, his attitude was a fairly common attitude at the time. There were, you know, very few young women writers at that time who emerged. I remember being terribly envious of Françoise Sagan, whose first novel was published around that time. She was 21. It was Bonjour, Tristesse. And she had this enormous play in the American press. Everybody marveled at the frankness of this novel. And she got away with it, I think, because she was French. So people thought it was a charming, exciting thing. If it had been an American girl, everybody would have been terribly shocked and disapproving. Even by 1962, when I published my first novel, Come and Join the Dance, some of the reviews were really ridiculous. How could this girl with a very good education, you know, in a place, you know, like Barnard College, you know, write about these sordid things? It was, you know, that kind of a review. I mean, you couldn't imagine a reviewer writing that way now.
Since the men in your circle were writing so much about their travels and crazy drug experiences around the world, did you ever wonder what a woman's story could be or what your story would be?
In some way, I sort of very stubbornly clung to my own notion of what it was I wanted to write. I wanted to write about young women. All this time that I was sort of on the beat scene and involved with Jack, I was actually writing about a young woman who was going to a college like Barnard and her sense of transition as she ended her years at college and sort of prepared to go out into the world and her first sexual experience. You know, this was not the kind of material out of which beat writing was made, but I felt this is what I really wanted to write about. Therefore, writing at that time for me, was a very, very lonely experience. People weren't interested in what I was doing. It didn't even matter to people that I had an actual contract from Random House for this book at the age of 21. And no one thought it could be anything that could conceivably interest them, except for Jack, who always took my writing seriously and read it and talked to me about it and gave me advice and praised me and was always, you know, as a kind of wise, more experienced friend, telling me that I should broaden the kind of experience I had. He was always urging me to travel, you know. He said that if we went to Mexico together, that would be very, very good for me as a writer. And he was correct. I've always regretted that I didn't travel more in those days.
What other advice did he give you about writing?
He was of the opinion that he believed in sort of spontaneous writing, that what you put down on the page first was the best, and that you should leave it pretty much untouched. This advice applied very well to him. I don't think it applied very well to me. I've always been a reviser. I think Jack himself became more self-conscious about his writing as time went on, and he dealt with various editors, and I think that probably was not a good thing for him. It took away some of his joy in writing. He became a little more self-conscious, and the writing weakened. But that, you know, advice like that about writing, it's a very individual thing. You can't generalize and say no one should revise, or, you know, everybody should write three drafts, or you should leave the page untouched. Each writer has their own way of writing.
Do you feel any connection to women who were coming of age in the late 60s during the counterculture and the radical politics of the period, who found that they too were minor characters in the circles?
I think they did find much the same thing, that they joined up with young men for whom they felt a real rapport and affinity, common ideas, and they found themselves in sort of traditional sort of wife caretaker roles. They were the person, you know, became the person who ran the mimeograph machine and made the coffee. And at the same time, I think things were a little bit easier for them, because I think the way had been cleared for them to you know, take some of the freedoms to leave their homes without so much pain. It was much more accepted to have a sexual life, but then they still encountered further complications. They were also much more conscious of what they were owed as people, as equals with men, than women were in my time, where we accepted a lot of stuff that we would have questioned rather violently a few years later.
You're a single mother now and an executive editor at the Dial Press. Do you feel that you've kept the values that you developed when you started living a bohemian life in the 50s?
I do feel that I have. I've kind of kept them inside me. I mean, I no longer live in the East Village. I live on the Upper West Side, which is a place I left forever in 1957. I've you know, worked. I've supported myself. For some reason, I've never been able to conceive of having someone else support me. And I've, you know, supported myself from the day I left college, even through two marriages. But I still feel very close in spirit to those times that I write about in the book. Although, as I said, that kind of community that I found at that time among writers and artists and the kind of excitement of those days is something that I don't find right now, that I miss. I wish it would come back. I think if it, you know, if something like that happened again, though, that women would play a very different and more active role in it.
Do you think you're going to be perceived differently now at the publication of this book, now that you've told your story about your life in your late teens and early 20s?
I think I will, and I'm glad I waited all these years to do it. I think I will be perceived as myself rather than as a person attached to another person.
You are an editor now. I was just wondering, do you think Kerouac had walked in with with the novel that was typed on one long piece of paper, that you would have had it published?
I think I would have been very intrigued as an editor looking at the long scroll rolling across my office floor. I might have fainted and thought how difficult it would be to work on this, but I think if I had, you know, found a manuscript like On the Road, even now I would have been enormously excited. And, you know, I went back and reread a lot of the books when I was writing this book, and I was still very much bowled over by that beautiful language.
Well, I really loved your book, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you very
thanks
much.
Thanks for being here.
I've enjoyed it, too.
Joyce Johnson has been my guest, and we've been discussing her new book, which is called Minor Characters. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, and Minor Characters is her autobiography of her life in her teens and early 20s when she went from her middle-class family in uptown Manhattan to downtown in Greenwich Village, where she became a part of a circle of artists and writers. And for 2 years, she was lovers with Jack Kerouac. She writes about that period as well. The book, again, is called Minor Characters, and the author is Joyce Johnson. It's published by Houghton Mifflin.